Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today is the British travel writer, memoirist and children's author. He's been a BBC producer on various cultural programmes and a travel journalist. And he's won or been shortlisted for many awards for his wonderful books. Horatio Clare, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's so great to finally have you in the studio because, as I understand it, you travel all over the world most of the time.
On Tuesdays and Wednesdays, I'm in Liverpool because I teach at John Moores. And so it's in university holidays, as it were. I do travel and I do move around a lot, but I have a four-year-old son. And so I'm at home as much as I can be. And when I can't be, I take him with me when I can too. So he loves hotels, aeroplanes. Watching him at three reading the safety card in a Boeing, I just thought, this is my son. So yes, I travel a lot.
And that very much comes through, that early wanderlust in your first books, because you've written a couple of memoirs. Your first one's called Running for the Hills, and that's all about your childhood. Tell us about growing up in West Wales.
Well, if you go to Cardiff and due north, it's that middle bit, and it's the green kind of bowl, and it's the Black Mountains. And my mother was a journalist, very like you, I think, when she was young, you know, in the eye of everything. And then she thought her posh friends had country houses, so she wanted one. And she went and bought a hill farm, 1,000 feet up, with 83 acres. And the farmer made her take all the sheep on. And her line on that is, if I'd known that each one was as sentient as a Labrador, and that they all had individual personalities and empathies, I would have thought twice. But so she discovered it, in her own words, sort of 20, 30 years too early, which meant that their marriage broke up and Dad went back to London. He's John Clare. He was the journalist, really, of his time in education and other matters. And we grew up as sheepdogs. I mean, my brother and I were just sheep farming and going to primary school. No TV, lots of books. Mum had been the Evening Standard's deputy literary editor. So we had loads of books. But apart from that, it was kind of medieval and it was wonderful. And Mum sold it to us as a great adventure. And it was. I mean, it was so sublimely beautiful and savage and wild. It was just miraculous. And we lived with animals as you would live with siblings. So we had a mouse that came every morning to eat the lentils behind us as we ate our Weetabix. And you could either shoot it or call it Vivian. It was like that. And I remember my brother shouting, "Will you be quiet?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "They are making so much noise." And it was the mice behind the wallpaper putting him off his Asterix book. And I grew up on oral story, I realised, because my mum talked all the time. And she told stories of her travels when she was a journalist, going with John Bulmer, you know, to meet the Mau Mau and photograph them for the Sunday Times when it was a great paper. And my dad, I remember he talked about Nyeri's funeral of Tanzania and going out onto an island in Lake Victoria and trying to get back and all the journalists standing there waving shillings at passing canoeists. And I just thought, yeah, I guess deep down I thought that the world was to be explored.
And do you remember where you first went? Where was your first journey?
We had some very strange ones. My mum used to put us on a coach from Victoria Coach Station because we had absolutely no money and go to Florence on coaches when we were very small. And I remember with my face pressed up against the window as we went through Switzerland at night, and I'd never seen anything like Switzerland. And, they just came straight out of the back garden. There'd be an Alp, like a vertical Alp. And so I fell in love with the idea of Switzerland, and I was also in love with penguins. And I realised that I was going to be a penguin farmer in Switzerland. And I think that's probably still my ambition.
Honest can you be in a memoir like that?
Well, that's fun, isn't it? That's a great question, because people meet you and they know that your dog was called Toss and they think they know you, and of course they don't. So you can be totally honest if what you're trying to do, which is what I'm trying to do, is get at truth. But on your way, you can leave out as much fact as you want. I don't warp fact, but I put it at service of truth. And so I've been a drug addict. You know, I loved marijuana when I was younger. I still do. And I've cheated on women. I've been a serial liar because my mum raised us kind of on emotional blackmail, which was you couldn't shoot the car engine with the air gun because it would break her heart. And she was so good at it that I just used to lie. And so the thing is, I never lie when I write. I never do and I never will. There's no point in writing if you're lying. So my fiction for children is all true.
Your second memoir, Truant, Notes from the Slippery Slope, talks about that drug addiction.
Well, that was about the 1990s, and why it was at 30, when I looked around my friends, all of them were slightly off track, and partly it was to do with the nonsense, which is British drug law, which meant that if we wanted to get high, a lot of people ended up smoking skunk, which is extremely bad for you. And I wrote it to explain to my grandmother, who was then passed away, and also to students, particularly innocent students, what the whole thing is with dope. And it's not a bad book. The problem is, I was scared of exposing my friends because I knew now what happened when you published a book and how you have to deal with things. And I didn't want to expose my friends, so I ended up writing more about myself. It was supposed to be the biography of a group and it ended up being about me, and I got bored with that despite my list of fantastic minor crimes. So there are some fun bits in it, but really the only good bit, I think, the really good bit is in the Chelsea Potter, 119 Kings Road, where I was a barman. So I went from the University of York, 2-1, loads of dope, Newcastle Chronicle and Journal, tabloid training by the Daily Mirror, taught to hack phones. And
by
then,
the Daily Mirror?
Yes, effectively. And then to Chelsea Potter, because I didn't want to be a tabloid hack, I wanted to write a novel. And I met this woman, and she was the best judge of character I've ever met. She was called Vanda, she was a Slovenian lesbian, eyes like grey skies, and huge. And she would say, "Sviti, look at all the little Kate Mosses." We were right opposite Storm Model Agency. And Vanda had an eye for people, like you wouldn't believe. And she said, "I don't care if you're stoned as mongoose, Sviti. You'll never lose a pound or a penny or an inch of beer." And I grew up that year, and I went from there to the BBC.
And writing about your friends, or not writing about them, as the case indeed proved to be, wasn't the same for your family, because your family were mentioned, particularly in your first memoir. So you were talking about truth and how important it is to the people in the book. Now, I know that you've read a book in which I appear. And so speaking from the other side as a kind of memoir victim, it's quite interesting to quiz somebody.
Yes, I bet it is. How did you feel? Scared when it came out?
No,
when you first read it?
Because you read it before it comes out.
I bet that's what I mean, though. What did you feel on first reading?
Slightly anxious about how it's going to be. But inevitably, I think you always just want to say things like, "Well, please don't say I'm fat."
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
it comes down to things like that, doesn't
absolutely.
It? Did you find that with your family?
Well, my decision to not write it as a first novel, because I could easily have fictionalised it just by changing, you know, the person from first to third, was that I didn't want to make compound characters and have people say that they weren't flattered or they weren't like that. I thought, just tell it straight. And I had a crisis in the middle of it. And Rob Kettridge, who's now kind of going for the running of Radio 4, wonderful man, my boss at the time, said, "H, all we're asking is that you give a true account of yourself." And that was like a light going on, because it meant that you could be wrong. As long as you're wrong from the point of view of the person that you're writing about, i.e. you, that's fine. So I informed myself about what had gone on between them, because I wrote the book to find out why my parents had divorced and what my role was in it and how much I was responsible for my bad and criminal behaviour afterwards and how much I could ascribe to the divorce. That's why I did it. So I didn't know what was going to happen to the book as I wrote it. And it was a wonderful experience because, of course, I came to understand that my father hadn't walked out on us. My mother had fallen out of love with him and kicked him off the mountain as much as he'd walked out on us. So that my entire narrative of childhood was backwards.
Do you think then that the travel was a consequence of perhaps running away from addiction and from all of those
early
crimes?
No, because, I mean, dope addiction is not physiological, it's mental. So you just like it. And I like it because I like the taste better than I like rolled cigarettes. So it's not that. I don't think it's running away. I just do love the road. I do love it. So, you know, in my time, as it were, you got a £125 ticket on your last day at school, and that was Europe Interrail for a month. Mm. And that was a blinding holiday. And I just never looked back, really. Before EasyJet came along, the world was still, you could cheaply actually see it through coaches and trains.
Mm.
And now you cheaply don't see it.
How did you end up in Palermo?
So I retired from BBC because I had sold Running and they'd accepted the manuscript, and I thought, it's now or never, because my masters and mistresses there, the brilliant Radio Arts Unit, who are the elite of the world at what they do, apart from Monocle, it turns out, they were proper artists at what they do, and also they had houses, you know, in places like Greenwich or Kentish Town, and they married well and they had wonderful children who had the whole world laid at their feet. And I didn't have children or a wife, and I thought, if you don't go now, it'll be too late. So I resigned. And I took a wonderful job from Barnaby Rogerson, who runs Eland, the travel publisher of the Times, really. And he said he wanted to do a book, Sicily Through Writer's Eyes, and would I do it? And I said, I'd do it, right, I'd do it. So I took, like, £1,000, and I went to live in Palermo for 6 months. And mostly I just photocopied all this stuff from Homer, you know, through Pirandello. Sicilian literature is completely off the scale. It's marvellous. And all I did was go to everywhere that was described in their writings and just describe it now and write linking passages. So that's how I came to live in Palermo. And it was one of those times where you don't have a partner, you don't have sex for 6 months, and you don't miss it. You just are happy. I was happy.
Because creativity fills that void.
Yeah, I mean, you're just working away at something not particularly difficult that's lovely and fascinating.
Mm. A Single Swallow. Would you say that was a defining book in your career?
Well, it's a great failure compared to the book that they bought. And so I had this idea I was staying at my friend's house, my then girlfriend's house in France, and I saw these birds land on the wire. And I was so pissed off about a royalty statement I'd had, which showed that I was making like minus £36,000 a year, or rather my just simply failing to earn it back. And I didn't want to write anymore. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And Claire said, look, there are so many books that need to be written. And as you probably know, the books business is run by women. And a lot of them believe that certain books... and that
quite
they can,
scary woman.
Yeah, well. But they can take a hit. You know, they're quite happy to burn Bertelsmann AG's money. And so I was looking for a commercial book, and I had this genius idea, thanks to these birds, I'll just follow them across country from Cape Town back to Cwmdi, South Wales. So my agent capped what we'd take as the advance, because she said, you'll just be bought out, it's such a strong idea. And this is just before Amazon, so it was shed loads of Nigella Lawson cash washing around. And wonderful Chateau, who we wanted, made me a lovely offer for that and a second unseen book, which became Down to the Sea and Ships. So then I did it, and I grew up, because I was fed up with being a young writer, which sounds so much like, if you'll forgive me, a young wanker. And I wanted to be a different person, and I thought, this will change me. And it did. I mean, I met my partner in the Hotel Tazi in Marrakesh. She was on a teacher's holiday from Rochdale. But that wasn't just it. It was something else. It was about fearlessness, trust of people. You soon learn in the Republic of Congo that if you don't throw yourselves on the mercy of every passing stranger, you're pretty well cooked. And I just found it so easy to make friends. And that's what changed me. The book's okay, but the point is that I did the journey. I left with the vanguard of the migration. So they are young males and they're desperate to get to Wales and get a house and be there ready with a long tail that will grow when they get there, ready for the ladies to turn up, who will turn up leisurely and pick the best houses. And so you left with them, but I arrived at the end of the migration about 3-4 months later with the main body. But as you know, 4 months trying to cross Africa is just ridiculous. So I should have gone back with them. But by that time I'd met Rebecca and I'd become a sort of stepfather to a six-year-old and there was no way. And anyway, I get very impatient with my books and I just want them to be over to do the next thing.
And in terms of the fact that this is about migration, how much of human migration is reflected in that?
Oh, well, that's the idea, you see. So I'm a political writer. Everything I do is for political reason. And obviously you have to disguise it. And the better you disguise it, the more effective it is. And this was quite simply not a book about swallows. I couldn't basically care less. I mean, I love them. But what it was about was human migrants. And so I'd written in the proposal, we will cross the Straits of Gibraltar as migrants. We will see Europe anew. And it just shows you should be bloody careful what you write, because by the time I got to Gibraltar, I was in the middle of a full-on breakdown. I threw my haversack into the sea with my notebooks and all my African treasures in it, because I was having a I'm not a white colonialist coming back from Africa with treasure moment. I abandoned my passport and card at Malaga Airport, because I realised that with a passport and a card, you can do anything. And so that was down to €3 by the time I made Madrid. And actually, what immigrants mostly have is a phone number. And in the Madrid telephone directory, I found a number of an old friend's parents. I got beaten up by the Guardia Civil. I mean, it was proper. As proper as a white boy is going to get from my kind of background. I did see what it's like. And then when I lived in Italy for 5 years, the lanes of Italy, you know, the vineyards of the Valpolicella, these dark, brave figures walking and walking, and they're selling lighters with naked women on them, or batteries. And these are the best and brightest of Africa. These are the people upon whom we will depend, and we treat them like shit. And I just loathe, what Swallow crystallised for me was an utter loathing of frontiers, of passports, even of flags. I loathe it. Culture doesn't need that kind of protection. All that frontiers do is make it easier for corporations and inept governments to plunder their people and resources. We should be one world. It is absolutely nonsensical and dangerous to continue down this fragmented idea, as if a flag matters, as if we're not all out of Indo-Europe at one point, as if we don't all descend from seven people. We need to get rid of them tomorrow. Brexit is the lunacy that proves the sanity. Borders are what is holding us back as a planet.
You went to, I suppose, the cradle of mankind, the Ethiopian Highlands.
Yes, I have been there. And also in the Serengeti, just north of the Olduvai Gorge, where we walked out and where there are footprints that show where we walked out. I've seen things. So I said I had a wonderful conversation on the way here with an Ethiopian taxi driver, Michael, who told me about the Hope of Ethiopia, which is a group called PG7, who are currently in exile with their leader in jail in Addis. And they're multi-ethnic, incidentally. So they're Amhara and Oromo. But I said to him, look, I'm a Christian, a Muslim and a Jew, and I've prayed with all of them. And you can't do my job without coming across God or the Great Spirit or the unexplained force or unknown science, whatever you want to call it. It happens pretty well every time I go abroad.
What do you call it?
God. God is a shorthand for goodness, and it's the force. It's quite simply, George Lucas made it very simple. That's what it is, obviously, and we all know it. So if you watch a bushman pluck a burning coal, and I mean burning coal, out of the fire, put it from one hand to another, decide it's not hot enough, put it back, pull out one that's white. Now, physics says it melts his hand to the bone in seconds. I watched him holding it for 20 seconds, put it down thoughtfully, and then lean over and heal the shoulder of a white girl who was living with the bushman, a rather wonderful activist and a former cover model, Alexandra Ulbeck-Nielsen, who's in Kalahari now trying to save these people, or help them save themselves, as she would say. And I said, what went on there? She said, oh, he healed my shoulder. She said, the funny thing was, it'd been on for a few days and I hadn't told anyone it even hurt. You've seen this stuff. You know what I'm talking about. You're an African.
You won an award for that, the Foreign Press Association's award for your feature, Rock of Ages. The Prince's Pen now is reworking of a very old story.
The Mabinogion. So Wales is blessed with a wonderful foundation text or collection of stories, obviously from the oral. And in the tale of Llyth and Llefelys, they're two brothers. And really, Llefelys ought to be king because he's brilliant, but Llyth is because he's older. And so Llyth is very clever because he asks Llefelys for help whenever he gets stuck. And he gets stuck three times. There's a scream that echoes through the land on May Day and causes all the cattle to miscarry and women. There's something that turns up and empties the king's chamber, i.e. the treasury, every New Year's night. And worst of all, there are the little people who've come from God knows where. They're fairy folk from Brittany, actually, from Breton legend. And they can hear everything that wind can catch. So you can't, and they've taken over, they're a dominant military force, you can't fight them. And so he goes to his brother and they meet mid-channel because Llefelys has sensibly gone off and married the Princess of France. And everything they say comes out hateful and contrary when they try to talk to each other down a horn to beat the little people. Llefelys realises what it is and he washes it out with probably Pendarian whiskey. And then they talk and he says, listen, you need to get them all together, throw water and insect mash over them and little people will die. The scream is a white dragon fighting a red dragon, which is fascinating when you think about faith. And you need to get those two dragons drunk in Oxford, which is the middle of Britain, and then bury them under Dinas Emrys, which he does. The last one is an enchanter. So I think of this as Goldman Sachs, which turns up in the night and empties the treasury. And he says, you need to stay up all night in a cold bath with a sharp sword, and when it comes back, you fight it. And so Llyth does. So I retold this in a modern way. The little people, I made a kind of... I thought of us in Afghanistan with our drones, you know? So like a drone-bearing army. And I made the Welsh, effectively the Taliban, Llyth's people. And I punned on insects, because what the myth is saying is that biological warfare will kill different ethnic groups, which is true, of course. But I couldn't face that, so I punned on it, and I have computer bug, so we hack the drones. And then the two faiths in my telling are Islam and the old British kind of Christian non-faith, which we all kind of have. And I have a debate in Oxford and more or less bury them.
Is it constricting or liberating working from a known text or a known story?
It's what poets say. It's the chains that set you free. It's great. Because I remember lying there for night after night thinking, how do I do The Enchanter? How do I do Goldman Sachs? How is that not going to be ludicrous? But I think I found a way. So yeah, it's wonderful. It's tremendous fun. Trying to work with someone else's plot is why Shakespeare had such a happy life, because he never had to worry about plot. Sensible man. I tell my kids, steal, 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 steal.
Well, let's talk about kids, because, of course, you're also a children's author.
Oh, yes, those kids. Yeah, I meant to have students. So I teach at John Moores. Yes, children. Well, so my son was born, and I read Roald Dahl again. And then I thought, actually, I really want to do this, because a long time ago, a woman at Hay, with my first ever book signing, came out of the mist and said, write for children, and then she vanished. And it took me a while. But when Aubrey opened his eyes, I could see a friend of mine in them who'd died, who'd been in a coma about the same time that Aubrey was born. It was odd. But he just looked completely indomitable. He's got like blue gun barrels like his mother. And so I thought, oh, that's interesting. I suffer from a thing called cyclothymia, which doesn't exist in Britain, but is easily diagnosed in France, which is a mild subset of bipolar. It means you get quite bad depressions and quite excellent highs. But it's not as bad as bipolar, it's not as severe, and you can't do anything about it, really, except take a sleeping pill every now and then. So I thought, so depression is the monster that can't be killed, and here's the boy that won't be beaten. And so I wrote Aubrey and the Terrible Ute, just like that. I'd never written without commission before. I thought it was a mug's game, and I'd never really written proper fiction. But I had, but, you know, the myth thing, not really. And it just worked. It was one of those. And so professionally, I can die, because I've written one good book, and it's Aubrey and the Terrible Ute. And the sequel, Aubrey and the Terrible Ladybirds, has just come out. But hopefully it's going to be a big book in France because they've gone for it, the first one. They've changed him to... He's called Casper in France. I was like, OK.
You've also written a secret book.
Well, I wrote The Paratrooper's Princess, which is set in a writing centre, and it's dedicated to all those people who've ever attended an Arvon course or to now. And it's just... I had such fun with it. So it's for Quick Reads, which is an organisation who want people to... who enjoy strong stories but aren't necessarily very literate or are not confident about vocabulary. Real readers, in other words. And so The Paratrooper's Princess is just fantastic. It's a guy who can't... I mean, I'm sorry to say this myself, but this idea is good. He can't read. And he meets this girl in a nightclub, and she's a rock critic for The Guardian, based on Laura Barton, actually. He's just like, he loves her. And she's like, I'm a journalist. And he's like, no, he hates words. And he's a real proper soldier who's always bluffed his way because he can't read. And so he goes on a writing course to be with her and wings it. So, yeah, that's my kind of less well-publicised book, but that's only because Accent Press don't have much budget for marketing.
Right. But the book that you contributed to that perhaps we don't even know you've written.
Oh, I only wrote a few paragraphs, pages of that, and that's The Great Big Glorious Book for Girls by Rosemary Davidson and Sarah Vine. And my girlfriend at the time was helping write some of it, and she asked me if I'd like to do it. So I wrote how to... So this was a knockoff, basically, of The Dangerous Book for Boys, which you remember stormed the shops one Christmas. And so I wrote about how to climb trees, how to throw stones, how to shoot. They cut that. catapults, knives, you know, all the stuff you'd want to tell your daughter, really.
Absolutely. We need to talk about ships now, because your new book has just come out, Icebreaker. But before that, of course, you wrote two books where you went, an account of two voyages on container ships.
Yeah, so I was really stuck. We were living in Italy in this box flat provided by the international school, and we weren't earning very much money. And I was writing for The Telegraph, like asparagus, you know, 1,200 words by 4 o'clock, which was keeping us going and all keeping us in having fun. And I knew if I could just hand in an acceptable manuscript of something, I'd get a whacking delivery advance, the deal on done on Swallow years ago when there was still money. So I had this idea. I was walking through Verona one misty night, and Verona has a dark side, fascist, horrid Northern League, racist. The immigrants say it's the worst place in Italy to get to be chucked off the bus. And that is what happens. They get chucked off the bus. Horrid. And I was walking through this mist. And in the winter, because it's between the Dolomites and the sea, the mist gets trapped and it starts to smell of burnt metal. And I was walking along the river, the Adige, which is gorgeous. And I had been reading Moby Dick. And the second line is along the lines of, when it is dank November in my soul, when my humours get the upper hand of me, when I have difficulty not joining every funeral cortege that passes and knocking strangers' hats off in the street, I count it high time to go to sea. And so I went streaming back to the flat and I emailed Maersk immediately, $24 billion company, 17% of world container trade, don't take paying passengers, have no interest whatsoever in journalism, because if they stop their engines, we're all fighting for dog meat in about 3 days. And I said, you need a writing residence. And this wonderful man in charge of their press office, Michael Christian Storgard, wrote straight back basically and said, yeah, you can go where you want. He said, you can write what you want. We won't even lawyer you. I was like, no. He said, we do globalisation. Without us, there isn't any. And we have questions about it. And nobody wants to talk to us. We ask them in isolation. Nobody knows who we are, really. So it was amazing. It was a total open goal. And I love ships. And I love the sea. And it was the best thing I've ever done, actually, pretty well. But the thing was, he'd said the same thing to Rose George, the brilliant writer and journalist, a few years previously. So that was a bad moment. In a seaman's hostel in Antwerp, I was about to catch a ship across the Atlantic in February, a really old ship. And she's actually subsequently caught fire and is now being scrapped. I found out about her on the internet. I was like, no! Oh, no! And so I rang my dad. I was like, Dad, I'm shot. The Fox is dead. Rose George has done it already, basically. She must be nearly finished, and she's gone on way more ships. I mean, she went pirate hunting with a Portuguese destroyer. She's amazing, Rose. And he said, you just have to do what you do better. There's room for both of you. And I thought, okay. So that's down to the sea and ships. And so the first voyage is from Felixstowe to Los Angeles via Suez, where they kicked me off. Rose was the last person they let go through. I don't know what she did to those pirates, but anyway. And I offered them my own ransom money, but they wouldn't take me. And then, so I rejoined in Tanjung Pelepas in Malaysia, and then we went up to through this amazing South China Sea and into Vietnam at night in mist. I mean, I saw a 23-year-old drive a 150,000-ton container ship up a twisting river with mist and fishing boats all around him in the dark. And his only defence really was this of the ship's horn. You see incredible things out there. I saw the sky on fire. over this oil rig off China. And then we went to a couple of Chinese ports and then went to Hong Kong. And we went through a typhoon. And my captain says, "You'll never forget your first voyage." He's this wonderful Danish sea dog. I said, "Oh, yeah, Captain, what was yours?" He said, "Suez. It was a 100,000-ton super tanker, a great big bomb." I said, "How did you survive?" It was during the war when the Iranians were shooting at super tankers. And he said, "We move at night and we hide by day. You never forget your first voyage." And we, sure enough, we set off. And he used this typhoon to arrow us, the tail of it, to fire us into Hong Kong. And when we left, all our rivals had dumped all their cargo and run off. So we got it because they have a cargo sharing agreement. So we had all of CMA, CMG stuff, and I think China Shipping, or maybe it's MSC, actually it's MSC. And we went out of Hong Kong and we'd loaded 115,000 tons. And it's like computers, spacecraft, cutlery, shoe polish, earwax. I mean, you can imagine it. And as we healed over, it took us about an hour to heal back. And then we went across the Pacific for 2 weeks and we jumped time every 2 days. And one day we crossed the datelines, we had the same day twice. And it was just incredible. And he said to me, "You see the time, Claire," when we reached Long Beach. "And the first thing you see of America is this tiny dark line of rock against a golden sunrise. And as you get closer, it resolves. And the Chinese called it Gum Shan, the land of the Gold Coast, the land of gold. And we still don't know who first did that crossing. And you get close and then you hear the United States Coast Guard, you hear the LA woman, and we reckon she was tall and blonde. And then you hear the San Franciscan woman, and we reckon she was shorter and brunette. Because, you know, we'd been away a long time. And we were discussing which we would rather marry. And the captain said, "You see the time, Claire?" And we crossed the line, which is where you pick up the pilot. And it was 2:30. He'd done it in 2 months through typhoons, dodgy pilots, pirates. He'd brought her in on the second. And he said to me in the lift, he said, "They will ask you when you get back what it was like, and you will tell them, and they will not understand, and they will imagine sunsets and sunrises, but they will never understand, however much you tell them, how vast the oceans are." And that was true. We think our world is small, but that's because we haven't sailed enough. It's huge. Huge.
That book was awarded the 2015 Stanford Donwan Book of the Year. It is a fantastic success, a bestseller. And now you've written Icebreaker. How did that come about?
So, my friend who I mentioned earlier, who died when Aubrey was just coming into the world, Thomas, and I were on lifeboats together in Atlantic College in 1991. And I love Thomas. He was extremely tall and very funny and horribly loud and dangerous and quick and just sort of really ludic and sarcastic. And he had mastered English so that people thought he was, like, taxi drivers always thought he was from Devon, but he was from Trier. A horribly dismissive individual. Anyway, he was a great teacher of lifeboating. His instructions were, "Don't fuck up!" That was it. And we had a mutual friend in Pekka, who's Finnish, and he was also on another boat, or maybe the same crew as Thomas, and they were great friends. And so Pekka's in charge of making us all realise that it's 100 years of Finland this year. So he'd read my piece in the FT about the ship's book, and he said, "Would you like to go on a government icebreaker?" So I just went ballistic with joy. There's always a penalty for that kind of happiness, I think. And said yes. And off I went. And I went on this icebreaker. And I met Finland for the first time and the real frozen north for the first time. I mean, on the ship, we went down around Flemish Cap, which is in that story of the Andrea Gale, the perfect storm. You know, they talk about Flemish Cap. It's the middle of nowhere. It's miles north of where the Titanic went down. And we were early in the year, but of course, there wasn't that kind of ice. We had pancake ice on the sea in storms, which is amazingly dramatic, and we saw a ghost ship. But on this one, this was proper. I mean, the ice was 20 to 40 centimetres thick, mostly 20 to 30. And they just have to keep it smashing it because it's really difficult stuff. You can't tell if a ship is going to stick. If she does stick, which way will the ice take her? You can't tell if she'll get free, how long she'll be free for, what speed she can make. You can't tell anything. So just because you've got 10 icebreakers and 10 ports doesn't mean that you're not constantly on the verge of total transport chaos. And if you drop the ball, and it was Tem, my captain, who was volunteered always to be the coordinating captain to everyone else's relief, he would say, "Everything will go wrong and we will fix it." And that is how they roll. And so they keep, and it's not, I was thinking it's going to be like shoes and coats and booze, which is what we took to Canada on my first ship, and milk and weird stuff. It was iron oxide, iron pyrite, pyritic iron ore, zinc, wind turbines. It was the actual bargain basement stuff of what you need to keep civilization going. And they were marvellous. I mean, they were the elite, those sailors. The thing was, Maersk are the best, basically. And the best Maersk crews are the best in the world for container shipping. But there's no question who the best icebreakers in the world are. And I had the privilege of being with them for 10 days. And the awful thing was, on the eighth day, I got butterflies in the stomach, and I know what that meant. I knew that I was about to face probably 2 months of near-suicidal depression. I thought it was because I didn't have enough material for a proper book. It wasn't that. It was also because I had like 6 weeks to write it, because they wanted it now, quite rightly. I'd said I could do it, and I normally could do it, but this was a struggle. I mean, I will never remember the writing of Icebreaker with a great deal of pleasure, but it was very professional. I just did it. I kept doing it.
And the depression?
Well, Rebecca's character, my partner, characterises my depression as she's like, oh, yeah, you want to die all through the winter, and then you go to hay and you hate it and you're scared and miserable and you think you smell, and then you have a great hay, and then it's whiskey for breakfast. So it's not quite that. But, yeah, it's a very predictable two-year cycle.
Tell me about the world of ice.
So the thing about ice is it's like crinkled water. Because the length of the hydrogen bonds can vary, ice is highly mutable. So it's a very, very changeable, very various substance. You get stuff between ice and snow, which isn't really either. You get very old, green, blue ice, which is multi-year ice. So that's what the ice packs used to be made of. And that stuff used to lock up all the first-year ice. But now, the first-year ice melts, doesn't become multi-year ice, and all that old stuff is coming out, carving basically off the kind of global ice cap, which is a real hazard if you're operating up there, which of course everybody desperately is as fast as they can because it's the future. So ice is fascinating, and you stand on it and it's amazing because you've got like blue, white, blue, and then over one side where the sun is, it's just in sort of melted light, and that's the albedo effect, and that's obviously radiation bouncing off the snow on top of the ice. That ice, single year, by itself is black. But with a layer of snow, it reflects solar radiation. If the snow melts or blows away, which is what is happening, or simply doesn't fall, which is what is happening, the ice melts, and you can see it. And that is our thermostat. If it goes, the stuff they really worry about is on the seabed. It was laid down in the last ice age. It is now melting. It has loads of methane underneath it. Methane is 23 times more effective at raising temperature than is CO2. They have modelled a date for methane release, and we are talking about bubbles of this stuff coming up from the sea, which will be a hazard, incidentally, because, of course, it won't support the weight of a ship. But bubbles of that, methane plumes, if that happens around 2030, 35, is what they think at the moment, large areas of the United States of America, Africa, and other places in the subcontinent are going to be devastated by flood, fire, and famine. If Trump thinks he's seen what the climate can do, he has no idea what the climate could do. Mm. Where we are as a species is we're standing watching a huge storm coming in towards us and marvelling at its side effects, which is great. We ought to enjoy that, because when it hits, it will not be fun. It really will not be fun. And the Finns know all about it. They have got nuclear shelters in the basements of every large public building, a legacy of the Cold War that they've kept going. They know that if you're nearer the ice cap, when the ice cap melts, your country will rise. So although they expect massive sea level rise, they know Finland's going up as well. Although the Bay of Botnia is a bit different, it's probably going to dry at some point. It'll be dry halfway down. And they're ready for it. We're not ready for it. And the world isn't ready for it. And, you know, it's really touch and go now if we're going to, how much we're going to mitigate it before it hits.
As you say, the Finns very sorted, and it's quite easy to succumb to Finnish stereotypes, I suppose. There are many sort of things that we all know about Finland. And I just wonder, we're talking now around the time of the 100th anniversary of Finland.
Yes.
And this book is enormously informative. It's beautifully written.
Thank you.
But it also tells us a great deal about the country and really about the last 100 years. If you were telling somebody who'd never come across Finland what it was and why we should celebrate its centenary, what would you say?
I think the European Union is one of the defining achievements of humanity this far. If you want to look at individual countries, can an individual country work? Finland is about as good as it gets. The horror of it is that 100 years ago, Finland was in the middle of, just about to enter, since this is December. In January, it would enter civil war between essentially white landowners and, you know, the professional kind of bourgeoisie and the Reds, the workers. And it would be vile. Lenin had given Finland independence. It had been a Russian for a century, and it had been Swedish 600 years before that. So it didn't exist as a country. Obviously, everyone called it Finland. They were Finns, but they were basically Swedish or Russian-dominated Finns. Anyway, civil war comes along. It's horrendous. Mannerheim, the white general, who was astonishing and actually spoke better Russian than he spoke Finnish, won it for the whites. And the treatment, it was this awful line that I'll never forget, the treatment of orphaned red children by the whites was apparently brutal. And so you've got to have a depth of almost an indescribable hatred to treat an orphan whose parents you've killed badly, I think. But anyway, that's what happened. So then Stalin, a few years later, invades. And Mannerheim had been saying for ages, look, let me retire or give me back the army, let me build it up. And they let him retire finally. And 2 days later, Stalin invades. And Mannerheim fought him to a standstill. He tactically, strategically won that battle, which was just incredible. And immediately Finland becomes one nation. And you don't fight the Finns. They are incredibly dogged. They're very clever. They're very laconic. They don't get worked up. I reckon they're pretty devious, actually, by some of the engineers I met. They're very, very thinking, lateral thinking people. And they've got this concept of sisu, which is a dogged refusal to be beaten, which I think we're all going to need. In fact, one of the sailors said that, you're all going to need it. And they beat, but he basically beat the Russians. Then they joined in Hitler's attack on Russia in order to get their territory back. And then they turned on German troops and drove them out of the country, and the Germans burnt the north of the country down in revenge, basically. So then they set about building the best country in the world. And they do that by, well, they pay a solidarity tax. So there's no arguing over what this tax is for. This tax is so that poor people don't have shit lives. Their education system is brilliant, and it's done by, not by testing at all, really, but by assessment. So you're assessed the entire time by somebody who really knows you. You don't have to start reading until six. Women have always been central to Finland's success. They are the secret key. They were much more liberated much earlier than anybody else. First people to get the vote. And so this wonderful British travel writer called Ethel Tweedie in 1898 sees Finnish women running building sites. And obviously this is because nature forms us in the best ways. This is why sailors are the best people often, because they are in true proportion to the planet. Farmers can be the same. And you can't farm in Finland if you're trying to keep your wife inside or treating her as if she's some sort of second-class citizen. That just doesn't work. And so how do they get mixed schools? Well, they put mixed housing up with a school in the middle of it. And the image of Finland for me was Tem's daughter is good at maths. And she's being taught maths by a Japanese girl. Now, this Japanese girl must be very clever because she's identified Finland as the most difficult place to get a teaching job, and she's done it. She doesn't speak Finnish. So this child and this math teacher communicate in maths. I thought, I just wish that was my kid, you know. Mm. And as a Brit, it's physically painful travelling through Finland because we could have everything that they've done. They've shown us how to do it. And it's just we're saddled with this terribly self-serving, anachronistic, corrupt sham that calls it the so-called government and the so-called ruling class of England, who must be deeply ashamed deep down. I mean, they've proved that you can send your kids to Eton, everyone can have a wonderful life, you can have houses and holidays abroad and pictures, etc. Well done, you. Congratulations. Great attempt. Great effort. Now, any chance you could use your extraordinary educations from All Souls, our kings or wherever, to put this country back on its feet? Is there any chance of that? None whatsoever. Oh, why not? Because most of you have never done a proper job in your life. You know? Boris Johnson was a fucking columnist and not even a good one. That is not a qualification for Foreign Secretary. I'm better qualified than Boris Johnson, and Rory Stewart's much better qualified. Hmm.
This sounds like an argument coming together for a book. What's next?
I'm going to do a biography of men. So instead of, like, travelling around the world, making the icebreaker or the ship the thing that you're buying, which is really what it's been, because my parents split up and I love my father so very much, I've always been fascinated by men. So I'm just going to do, effectively, a travel book where I'm going to write about the best and the worst and the most interesting men I've ever met. And I'm going to meet a few more for the purposes of the book. But that's not what I'm writing at the moment. I'm doing a biography of winter for Elliot and Thompson. So we're going to buy a Land Cruiser and drive to Hamburg to look for winter. And because I do love a ferry. And then I've got this thing that I'm halfway through, which what my agent cares about, which is about a stepfather and a stepson, called He Bought a Castle. Because I had the most incredible stepfather. Gerard Morgan Grenville started the Central Alternative Technology in North Wales. He invented tourist barging in France. He always looked incredible, like Eton and the guards, but he never seemed to have any money. He was an absolutely amazing man. And he was my stepfather, for a while. He was my mother's lover, to be frank. And I have a sort of stepson, although I'm not married to his mother, Robin, who's a 6'5" Mancunian 16-year-old now and won't give me his phone if I want to take it off him. And I thought I'd quite like to put him at 10 and my stepfather together in a ruined castle with no Wi-Fi and see if Gerard, which was his name, going to call him Guy again, he's Guy in Running for the Hills, can persuade this child to read books by, you know, producing a sword stick and saying, shall we read The Prisoner of Zenda and then have a sword fight? So that's my idea.
Well, I certainly hope that you're going to put yourself in your biography of men, because you are absolutely one of the most interesting men that I have ever met. Horatio Clare, thank you so much for coming on Meet the Writers. And Horatio's book, Icebreaker, A Voyage Far North, is published by Chatto & Windus. It's out now.
You're too kind. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to George McDonough. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.